student at the Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Chicago, and I also work at the Argonne National Lab. And I'll be here next year as a postdoc. So this has been work that I've done. So the first paper has been work that I've done with Nosheen Shaw and Carlos Wagner, where we study the electroweak symmetry breaking part of the scale shift unification scenarios in warp extra dimensions. And then the second paper is work that all these authors have been involved in. And there we study the collider phenomenology basically a heavy quark resonance, a heavy top resonance. Thank you. So, so let me start giving you. You cannot see very well here, but let me start giving you an introduction, a very basic introduction to the Randall syndrome. It's called the Randall syndrome one type scenario. So the idea is that you have an extra spatial dimension. And so you can basically, this is the metric, how the metric is given by, so you can put this AND set and then solve this extra dimension, by the way, is compactified on a circle. So you can start with this AND set for the metric and show that this solves the 5D Einstein equations of motion. So as you can see here, you have basically the Minkowski metric, and then this factor here, which is basically what is going to cause the warping of the metric in the extra spatial dimension. Here, this y in this case is an angle, and r is the radius of your circle where you are compactifying the extra dimension. So, like I said, this is a solution to the 5D Einstein equations of motion, and when you impose that you want Poincaré 4D Poincaré symmetry to be conserved, then it turns out that this becomes a slice of ADS5, so anti de Sitter space in this extra dimension. And through this warp factor, you can show that if the energy scale at this brain, let's call it the UV brain, the one that corresponds to, in this case, y equals 0, is M Planck, then the energy scale, depending on this radius here, can be brought to be of the order of the TeV at y equal pi. So this is the way how you relate the five-dimensional Planck mass to the four-dimensional, and then there is this warp factor here. So if this is big, then basically all these things, and you assume that k is also of the same order as the Planck scale, then basically all these things have the same scale. So in that case, if you localize your Higgs field, you have a scalar that is localized near the infrared brain, then through this warping, you can show that the bed that this scalar gets on this brain is of the order of the TV scale. So this is the way, if KL is of the order of 3. So this is the way how you solve the hierarchy problem in this type of scenario, basically using the geometry of your space-time to bring down your cutoff scale, if you want, to the order of TV. So in the initial Randall syndrome scenario, you had all the fields, all the standard model fields live in this brain, in the infrared brain, and then this is how you solve the hierarchy problem. Okay. So, however, then people realize that you don't need all the standard model fields in the infrared brain. What you only need near the infrared brain is the Higgs field. You can actually put your bulk fermions and gauge bosons in the bulk of these five dimensions. When you do that, obviously, what's going to happen is you're going to get KK modes. Basically, when a KK decomposition, what it is, you can think of it as a Fourier, if you want, a Fourier series. So you have a compact extra dimension, therefore, instead of having just a continuum, you have KK states in this, caused by this compact extra dimension. Now, when you put your fermions in the bulk, and you introduce this Dirac mass in the bulk, this actually has to come from a kink profile to make it work, because otherwise it vanishes. So it vanishes on the boundaries, but you can write it on the ball. Then it turns out that you can understand the hierarchy in the fermion masses basically from the profiles in the extra dimensions. So what you'll do is you'll identify your standard model fields with the zero modes of this decomposition. And then depending on what's the value of this bulk mass, the C value there, the profiles of the zero modes in the extra dimension can peak towards infrared if C is less than 1/2 of the left-handed fields, for example. Or they can peak on the ultraviolet brain if C is bigger than 1/2. So since our Higgs field lives in the infrared brain or near the infrared brain, you see that when you actually integrate over the fifth dimension, if this thing peaks towards here, it's going to get a bigger mass than if it peaks towards the UV brain. When you do this, so you get what's called a zero mode in the case where your field doesn't vanish, so it has Neumann boundary conditions on the UV and on the infrared brain. However, you can have mixed modes, so if you have a minus plus or plus minus, so plus plus here I denote the Neumann conditions, minus would be the Dirichlet one. So however, if you have minus plus, plus minus, or minus minus, then there is no zero mode. Okay? And the basic the energy scale or the spectrum is always defined in units of this this energy scale, which I'm going to call k tilde, which is k to the minus kl. So you see how when we introduce the gauge bosons and the fermions in the bulk, actually we can construct, depending on how these things, how the profiles of the zero modes are, we can construct a theory of flavor in the extra dimension. Now the problem that arises when you put your gauge bosons and your fermions in the bulk is that you're going to have to start having corrections to the precision electroweak parameters. For example, the T parameter, which basically gives you an idea of the MC over M value. And this happens because once you have your Higgs field, your Higgs is going to mix zero modes with KK modes. This is basically, this comes from the kinetic term, right, of the Higgs. You're going to have mix between the zero modes and the KK modes. And that obviously induces corrections to this parameter. Therefore, the way to, or what that gives you is a constraint on the masses of the states, of the KK states. And it tells you that the masses have to be bigger than 5 or 10 TeV. So things that you wouldn't see at the LHC. This you get similar constraints also from C to dV bar, right? Here again from the kinetic terms, and here from Yukawa interactions, which also push your KK scale to be between 7 and 8 TeV. So, I mean, you can live with this, but if you want to make the model appealing for the LHC, you actually will want to try to bring this scale a little bit down. So people work that out. And the solution, so this is all at tree level, what I was showing just now. The solution that they found is that you can enlarge your bulk gauge field, gauge symmetry, to include an SU2 right symmetry, okay? And when you do that, actually you notice that there are cancellations between the left-handed and the right-handed parts of your field, which make, so Agashi, Delgado, Sundrum, May, and Sundrum were the ones that proposed this. And then you can also include a left-right-handed symmetry, doing by this, basically. And this will, make cancellations between the right-handed parts to the CB bar couplings. So that lets you bring the scale down to the order of 3 TeV, which becomes phenomenologically interesting, especially for collider tests. An alternative to this is actually to assume that there are large brain kinetic terms, and those usually what they do is they push things away from the brain. And if you're interested in that, you can take a look at this paper. So this is at tree level. However, when you look at loop level, there are still big corrections from loop levels. And those big corrections, what they do is basically they constrain the parameter space of your theory. So if you want to have things to be consistent, that gives you a constraint on the parameters of your theory, on the bulk masses specifically. Okay. So let me introduce the idea of this holographic Higgs or of gauge Higgs unification. The idea is the following. So, like I told you before, we want to have SU2 right symmetry, gauge symmetry, and we want to have this left-right parity symmetry. So an easy way to include all those things if we enlarge the basically the electroweak part of the gauge group to be SO5 cross U1X. And SO5 contains SU2 right plus SU2 left. And well, we'll need U1X basically to get the right hypercharge. So what we can do is we can break, by boundary conditions, we can break this gauge group to SU2 left plus U1Y on the UV brain. And then we'll break it to SO4 plus U1X on the infrared brain. And like I told you, SO4 contains SU2 right plus SU2 left. Therefore, we'll have this custodial symmetry that will still protect the T parameter. And as a bonus, if you want to think about it like this, the coset group, SO5 slash SO4, so that's the one that we actually break on both brains, since the mu components of this coset field have minus-minus boundary conditions, we're breaking it at both brains, then just because of the gauge structure, that implies that the fifth component of this gauge field has plus-plus boundary conditions. And therefore, this thing will develop a zero mode, okay? And we can identify this field with the Higgs. So basically, you can this field takes the form of a bidoublet, and then you can identify the doublet component under SU2 left with the Higgs field. Now, from the just gauge symmetry, there is no tree level for this Higgs field. There's no Higgs potential. However, it is induced at one loop level just from radiative corrections. And that's actually the work that we did initially with the Nosheen Shaw and Carlos Wagner. We calculated the Coleman-Wyman potential, and then we studied the minima, the electroweak symmetry breaking minima in the parameter space, demanding basically that we get the right CW mass, the right bottom quark, the top quark between some ranges between 140 and 170 GeV. And then we can also, from the potential, we can get an idea of the Higgs mass, just taking the second derivative of the potential, and see where it lands. We study this in what I denominate here the linear regime, where the Higgs couplings are linear. And you'll understand that when I'll show the actual Coleman-Wyman potential, what I mean by the linear regime. So let me go to the actual model. So the phi T action for the gauge fields and the fermions is given by this. This is just the determinant of the metric, right? The normal kinetic terms. Here's the mass of the fermions, the bulk mass. G5 and GX are the five-dimensional, dimensionful gauge couplings. I mean, they have dimensions because we're in five dimensions. So they go like basically as G over square root of L. And I will denote the generators of the left-handed SU2 left and SU2 right as TA left-right, and of the coset as A hat. So A hat would be the index of the coset. So to get the right hypercharge, actually you need to rotate the third component of your fields of the three rights, or of the right and the field, and then this BN, which is the U1X. You know, you do this rotation, and then you get the right hypercharge. Okay? You identify basically sine square of phi with the tangent of theta 1. So, like I told you before, we're going to impose the braking on the UV brain and on the infrared brain, and we want this ones to have a zero mode, or to be non-vanishing on the UV brain, but we want the right-handed one and the hat mu to be vanishing. So we impose the braking that is necessary, and like I told you, then you can identify the fifth component of your gauge field with the Higgs. So, again, the usual way to attack these problems when you have gauge fields on the bulk is to do a KK decomposition, which is what we have here. And here, actually, we single out already what will be the Higgs field and what's the way that it behaves on the fifth dimension. Basically, it goes like a double exponential, so it peaks towards the infrared brain. The fact that it has this form can be it basically comes from you don't want this guy to be mixed with the A mu's, okay? It's the zero mode, and therefore that's why it takes this form of a double exponential. So the idea will be to put all that KK decomposition in the Lagrangian or in the action, then integrate over the fifth dimension, use orthonormality, and then try to bring it to this form here, okay? So where you get a kinetic term for the gauge field and then this other guys. Now, however, it turns out that solving the equations of motion when you have the Higgs is difficult. since the Higgs actually makes states. And therefore, a better way to do this is actually through a gauge transformation. I mean, actually, after all, the Higgs comes as part of a gauge field. So we can go to a gauge where we actually remove the Higgs. Okay, we're going to call it the H equals zero gauge. And the way to, and so we can go to that gauge, solve the equations of motion when there is no Higgs, and then come back to the gauge where there is a Higgs. Okay, and that's, so the way to do that is through this gauge, large gauge transformation given here. Okay. So and then to recover the profiles in where there is a Higgs, this is the way you have to do it. So the solutions in the H equals zero gauge are basically, there are, you can think of them as cosine and sines, and are given by these functions, which are, these are Bessel functions right here. Okay, these are well-known functions. And so this one actually is non-vanishing at zero, and this one vanishes at zero. And once you have those solutions, like I told you, you can rotate them back and go to the H non-zero of the H. So, yes, go ahead.
So are your boundary conditions, is this gauge transformation consistent with the boundary condition as well?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, definitely this is what I'm talking here. So, you know, you want, if you want the, so like I told you, this one is non-zero at x5 equal to zero, and this one is zero. So what you will want is you're going to put this profile, you're going to identify it with the left-handed gauge fields, right? The ones that you don't want to break. And this one is going to go to the ones that you actually want to break. So you're gonna put for the SU2 right part, you're gonna have this profile when H is non-zero, sorry, when H is zero, and this, the SU2 left is going to have this profile. Okay? So the UV boundary conditions are actually automatically satisfied.
From a 40 point of view,
yeah,
this thing is a physical state. How can you go to a gauge which is where it's not there?
Because it's part of a gauge. I mean, the Higgs is basically is part of your gauge field, right?
This is 5D, but from a 40 point of view.
Well, but from 5D, why wouldn't I be able to do that?
Because I'm just trying to understand whether it's consistent with the boundary conditions. Just from the 40 point of view, it's not clear how, what is the gauge transformation that will switch you away from a physical Higgs to a phase where you don't have a physical Higgs.
Actually, I think I have an answer for that. But this is what is called the Hosotani mechanism. So it's related to that. And basically what it is, like this, is this, it's a large gauge transformation. I don't know if, and you're doing it in bulks. Well, yeah, you're doing it in bulk. You're doing it everywhere. You're doing it everywhere. It's not that you're doing it at any point. You're doing it everywhere. So, I don't see why it wouldn't be consistent, though. I mean, I'm going to use the infrared boundary conditions.
Yeah. Are you saying that that this physical degree freedom disappeared once you're in this gauge, or it shows up somewhere?
Let's see. I mean, we never analyzed that, but I imagine that. That it must show up. Yeah, it's not that it disappears. It definitely shows up. I don't think that it disappears. It's just that, imagine it shows up in your boundary. Well, that's what it does, actually. It's not that it disappears. It shows up in your boundary conditions. So
that's what I'm asking. So the boundary conditions are not invariant on the schedule solution?
No, they're not invariant.
Okay,
yeah.
So now everything's
okay.
Okay.
So the boundary conditions are not consistent.
No, they're not.
Okay, now it's
exactly. And this is actually what I would use. I mean, actually, the UV boundary conditions when H is equal,
yeah.
Okay, in the UV brain,
yeah.
The UV boundary conditions are automatically satisfied.
Yeah.
However, in the infrared brain, yeah, they change.
Okay.
And it's actually this change, you know, when you want to solve with the H equals zero, in the H non-zero gauge, is this this system of equations that you have to ask to have a non-vanishing result. So to get a non-trivial solution for the masses in the infrared brain, you demand that the terminal of that system of equation vanishes, and then you get the KK spectrum basically of your gauge fields. Okay, and you can identify, well, any of this equation has to vanish, you can identify this equation with the C KK spectrum, and this one with the W KK spectrum. Okay? And this FH here is basically it's given by this integral, so integral over the profile of the of your Higgs field. Okay? So we have the basically what's the spectral functions, if you want, of your theory are given here.
Very good.
So we deal with the bosons. Now let's deal with the fermions. Now the fermions, what we'll do is we'll put them in SO5 multiplets. And actually, we're going to restrict ourselves just to the third generation. We didn't study flavor or anything. I mean, yeah, we didn't study flavor in these models. And we work with the third generation basically because that's the one the most important to for the calculation of the potential. It's the one that is going to play the role, an important role. So we introduce three multiplets, okay, here, two fives and one 10. The fives can decompose as a bidoublet plus a singlet, and the 10 can be decomposed as a bidoublet plus two triplets. And so we want these things to have would be zero modes. So this would be the top, this one would be the bottom. Here, the two-thirds and the five-thirds, all those are the electromagnetic charges. And the plus-plus or plus-minus, those are the boundary conditions, the UV and the infrared plane. So we want to identify this part with the top and the bottom, like I told you. And then, I mean, you could try to work this with just one multiplet and think, you know, if you put minus-minus here, then the opposite chiral has plus-plus boundary conditions. But if you do that and you want to construct the top mass, then you get problems with the T parameter becomes negative. And you don't want that. You want the T parameter to be positive. So that's why you introduce a second multiplet. And here you identify the top right with the singlet of this multiplet. Okay, these are the other boundary conditions for the bidoublets. And then you put the decuplet and identify the bottom right with this component of your triplet, of this triplet. Now, it is obvious that if I put just this and nothing else, then I won't get the right top mass because I need to have coupling. I need to mix the states. So I want a mix of these two states. And that's why you introduce boundary mass mixing terms at the infrared plane. Okay? Now, this masses will actually mix the singlet component of this field with the doublet component there. So that is, sorry, the singlet with the singlet, and then through the Higgs, it's going to mix with the doublet. So those are these masses here, and then there is also a boundary mass here that makes the bidoublet, this bidoublet with this bidoublet. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Can you comment on, so in one case you have simple boundary conditions of a complicated equation of motion.
Yes, exactly.
And the other you have complicated equation, sorry, simple equation of motion
but
complicated boundary
exactly,
condition.
That's what it is.
But why is it easier to solve it with complicated boundary conditions but simple equation of motion?
Because the way that when you have complicated boundary conditions, say, well, that's what we basically did. I mean, the complicated boundary conditions, what you do is you ask to have a non-vanishing solution, right? You don't need to solve. I mean, we want to solve, for example, for the KK spectrum. I need to solve each solution. Right? I just have a system of equations, and I demand that that system has a non-trivial solution for Z, which is basically the mass of this thing, okay? And then I solve the determinant of that system.
But
okay? And that's how I get the KK spectrum.
So if you look at the equation of motion, you can find the right decomposition for them in terms of eigenmodes. But then you still have to show that with a complicated boundary condition, it may not be so trivial to find what the
It is pretty straightforward. You just, like I told you, you have your system, you have the system of equations, which they have to satisfy the boundary conditions in the infrared brain, and then you just ask the determinant to be zero. And that's how you solve for the spectrum. It's pretty straightforward. There's not much complication. Once you get these things here, this term basically is going to affect your boundary conditions. So that's the way to deal with this type of terms. Okay. So the solutions to the equations of motion in the H equals zero gauge can be written in terms of this function here, which I call S tilde M, takes this form, depends on C, the Boltzmann mass. Again, Bessel functions. And then basically because your first order, I mean, the equations of motion for this for the fermion fields actually mix left-handed guys with right-handed guys. So they are mixed. They are mixed equations. So you can actually construct a second-order differential equation just for one of them. But then once you have this solution, the right-handed one is related to this solution, okay, or to the derivatives basically of the solution, which is this, which I call S dot there, okay. So we can write everything in terms of this S function and its derivatives, and that's what Anders okay. This satisfies some normalization condition in this case. So you can do that, okay, and then so you can write again your let me call it vector functions in the H equals zero gauge, okay. And like I told you, they are basically either S or S dots, whether they have, in this case, these guys are the ones that have a zero mode, the S dots. The S are vanishing at the UV ring. So you construct your vector functions, okay? This is the singlet, this is the structure of the bidoublet. You can do something similar with the decuplet. And again, so once you have this, you apply the gauge transformation. These are basically matrices to make the gauge transformation a little bit simpler. What I say here, you try to go from the SSP into the canonical base. But canonical, I mean just 1 0 0 0. And once you have your functions in the non-zero gauge, H non-zero, you demand that they satisfy the boundary conditions. And again, this gives you a system of equations, which it has a non-vanishing, a non-trivial solution if the determinant of that system is zero. So when you demand that, you get these equations, which they're not pretty, but that's what it is. And so basically, this will be the equation for the bottom KK spectrum, this one here. These are some exotic fermions that you have, different charges actually. And then this is the equation for the top KK spectrum, okay. Takes this form. So once you have this and you can construct, you have that again, spectral functions, it's very easy to construct the Coleman-Weinberg potential, which takes this form right here. It's basically the integral of dp over p cubed log of the spectral functions. Again, you have them already. So this is the contribution from the fermion fields, and this one, the bottom, the top, and this is the contribution from the W and the Z. And you see that it's actually the top here, the one, you know, this is what I mean by linear regime. Linear regime, so this H actually has the bed here of the case. So linear regime is when this parameter here is small, and then I can do a Taylor expansion of the sign. So basically this part here is what's gonna give you the core decoupling, okay, for the Higgs field, if you want to think about it again. So the top plays a very important role to break the electroweak symmetry. Yes?
Sorry, I insist about that.
Yeah.
So I agree that you can write another determinant equation,
yes,
and you can probably verify that there is a zero mode. But
there is let me not call it zero mode. Usually, are masses. Yeah, but yeah, there's
a. But is it clear that you can get the spectrum and the right wave function out of this?
Yes, I mean this is basically the spectrum for your KK masses, right? It's this simply. This and this, I mean all of them. This gives you the spectrum of your KK masses.
Good. You get the whole spectrum and wave function out of this one equation?
No, here I just get the spectrum. This is just the spectrum. I'm not in this at this moment. I'm not interested in the real profile of the states. Just on the spectrum, and this is the way to get it.
Pretty good.
Okay, so once we have the Coleman-Weinberg potential, then we can study it in terms of the parameters of the theory. Remember, we have the bulk masses, and then we have the boundary masses. And so that's what we did. We did a numerical study of the potential, trying to find where we have electroweak symmetry breaking. And we restrict ourselves this is an oscillatory solution, right? So we took this thing to vary between 0 and pi over 2. We restrict ourselves to there. And yes.
So in the Coleman-Weinberg potential.
Yeah.
If you don't know the profile of the Higgs in the bulk, how do you do the contribution from the fermions?
I don't know the profile of the Higgs in the bulk. I do know the profile of the Higgs in the bulk, right? That's why I showed before.
The profile of the zero mode is from
the profile of the kicks of the on the bulk is given by basically this exponential.
You just said that you cannot get a wave function from.
No, this is the Higgs. For the Higgs, I can, right? The Higgs, this profile, this solution comes from demanding that you don't get a mixing between the zero mode of this field with the KK modes of the A mu's, or with the A mu's. You know, when you write the kinetic term, there's going to be a mixing, okay? And I don't want the zero mode to mix with the other states. So when you demand that, that's how you get this solution right here. Okay. Now there's going to be definitely mixing between the KK modes of the Higgs, the other things, and that's what's going to that's going to affect the other field. But this solution actually comes from demanding that the zero mode doesn't mix. Okay, so when we do the numerical study, basically we restrict ourselves to two regions. One where this parameter is less than 0.3, this number is a little bit arbitrary, but we took it to be 0.3. And then another one where this is bigger than 0.3. We call this the linear regime, and this the nonlinear regime. So as you can see, we took a very big range of top masses, between 140 and 170. But in that case, in the linear regime, you see that the Higgs mass usually is between 115, say, and 160. So this is one of the predictions of the model. You get a Higgs mass, or a light Higgs mass, if you want, between 115 and 160 GeV. Okay. We can blow up that region actually a little bit more, and then you can see it probably here better, that for the linear regime, you get this. This Higgs mass between 115 and 160. For the nonlinear, you can get smaller Higgs mass, but we don't know how to interpret the nonlinear regime. I mean, things become nonlinear. It's hard to interpret this region. This is the one that we can actually compare with the electroweak precision test. I don't know how you can compare that one.
Okay.
So here's another plot where we have the Higgs mass versus this K tilde scale, and basically what it tells you that for the linear regime, which is this one, your K tilde basically takes value from 1.5 dB up all the way. Okay?
Great.
I mean, if you were in the nonlinear, you can make it smaller, but hard to interpret that theory. Here is just a plot where we show that as MB1 becomes bigger, you actually get way into the nonlinear regime. So if you want to get into a linear regime, this MB1, which is the mass in the boundary, which makes it the singlet, has to be between 1 and 2. Pretty constrained.
Normal values, natural values, if you want.
I have a question.
Yes.
What parameters are you scattering over?
Okay,
maybe I should write it down.
So there are the boundary masses, which I call MB1 and MB2. This one is the one that mixes the singlets. This one is the one that mixes the bidoublets. Then you have C1, one of the bulk masses, C2, so the first multiplet, the second one, the third one. And if you want, you can determine K, the related to the curvatures, in the fifth dimension. You can determine K by, the way that we determine it is by demanding that we get the right W mass. Okay? So really, it's this parameter that you scan over. Okay.
What range is
there? Well, in principle, it could be any range. We did like a, you know, like a coarse grid where we scan C1. I mean, the bulk masses, we scan them between minus 1 and 1. And then this MB1s and the boundary, we took them between 0 and 5. Okay.
Can you say one more? What is MB1 and MB2?
So MB1 and MB2 are the ones, the masses that mix the singlets of the fermion fields, so of the multiplets in the infrared range. Okay. So usually these numbers, you know, to be natural, quotation marks, it should be of order one, this one's here. And you don't want also to move this bulk mass to make it too big or too small. So this is like the natural region of parameter where you would scan. And that's what we do. And these are the results that I'm showing here in this figure. So you see, I mean, this is trivial. Basically what it says is that this goes like 1 over k tilde. This just tells you that for in the linear regime, basically you're taking values of k tilde between 1.5 up.
Okay.
And for phenomenology, you want to be somewhere over here. Okay. So here in this one and the next figure, I'll just show the regions of parameter and of the bulk masses where we get the electroweak symmetry breaking consistent, top with the top mass, the bottom mass, all those masses. And the interesting thing about this figure is really that this region of parameter space, and the same with this one here, is the one that is consistent with the electroweak precision test, which in principle it didn't have to be like that, but it is. So the amazing thing is that we came from like another avenue, study the parameter space, and the regions where we get electroweak symmetry breaking minimas that are consistent with the W mass, the top mass, the bottom mass, is the same region that is consistent with electroweak precision test. That was one like interesting thing result that we got in this work.
True.
Yes.
I mean, probably the other way. If you had W, which is 100 GeV, you obviously be away from precision.
But W, I mean. Yes, well, but then you have the KK states, right? You have all the KK states.
But you started out with custodial.
Yes.
And
yeah, definitely.
And you don't really have a problem with S parameter.
Yeah.
So how could you be?
No. But there could be other regions, right? Why did it have to be this one? It could be other regions in this parameter space, in this five-dimensional.
Not other regions. How could you violate? How could you violate precision relativity?
No, but we found the.
You had custodial in the block, and
yeah.
You don't have problems with S parameter. So how could you violate precision relativity from the bottom?
The T parameter at least was only studied at one loop, I think, and that was those corrections. I mean, that's what constrained the system, and when they studied it just from the electroweak position test. I don't know if there may be other corrections at higher loop that may actually constrain the system more or not. What I'm saying is that we studied from a different point of view, just looking at what is consistent from the electroweak symmetry breaking case, and we actually landed in the same region of parameter space. How much time do we have? Not much, or because then comes like another section.
15 minutes.
Okay. So let's see if I can make it fast. Okay, so like I told you, we have the KK spectrum. Spectral functions, and therefore we can actually get all the KK masses that we care. And for example, when you get the here, we made a plot of the first three resonance of the top, so the first mass resonance of the top versus the first excited state of the W. Okay. And this line here is MW1 over 2. Okay. And what you can see here is that the first KK resonance of the top actually is always less massive than half of the W1 mass. Okay, and this will be interesting from the point of view of phenomenology, especially not so much for the W1, but for the KK excited state of the gluon, G1, which has a similar mass. I mean, when these things are heavy, and therefore the Higgs actually doesn't influence much the mass. So you see that in the case of the linear regime where C1 is positive and you want C1 positive, just because of some flavor constraints, you don't want your states, your zero modes, to be too close to the infrared brain where you get mixing with the KK states. You want them actually closer to the UV brain. So that implies that C1, you want C1 positive. So these are these blue dots here. You see that always here in this region, the T1 mass is lower than half the W mass. So you can have actually decays of the G1 state can decay into pairs of T1s. And this is actually what motivates us to do the collider phenomenology in the next slides that I'll show. There are also, like I told you, there are also, since you have this multiplet and there are states we have like exotic quantum numbers. For example, there's this state U1, which we call here U1, that has actually 5/3 electromagnetic charge. Then there are regions of parameter space where actually this state is light enough that you could actually have decays of W1 or G1, whatever, whichever excited gauge boson to this state. Okay. So I mean, however, in the regions that I'll be studying in the next slides, and I'll show you in the next slides, where we take C1 positive, usually this U1 is too heavy to come from the case of this G1.
Sorry, what is U1?
So E1 is the first excited state. Let me show you. It's this guy. Okay. So it's the KK mass of the first excited state of this one, which has charge 5/3.
Oh.
And it turns out to be light. That's what I'm saying. So you can have exotic fermions that you may be able to discover at the other side. Okay. That was someone. Okay, very good. So, okay, so now you were asking about profiles, and this is where we actually have to deal with profiles. So we did a study. Okay, so what we wanted to study was the case of this G1 excited state into pairs of excited tops. And then the idea behind this was that there had been studies of heavy quark and analysis of heavy quarks and how the possible detections are colliders. But usually all of them came from QCD production. Okay? And now we have this new excited state of the gluon that actually is going to influence a lot the collider phenomenology. So we wanted to study this and see if we could actually extend the reach of this to probe the masses of this heavy quarks. So the T1s decay into WB, Higgs top or C top, and to get the couplings of, for example, of G1 to pair of tops of T1 or whatever T1 T1, you have to you have to integrate over the fifth dimension. So what happens is that those equations that we had before, okay, on the infrared boundary conditions, you can basically separate them in charge, okay. So all the things that are charged 2/3 are going to mix, and depending on the quantum numbers that you want, you can identify the profiles. Okay, you can calculate the profiles in a way of the states, and then once you have the profiles, you can integrate the profiles. This is the one that corresponds to the G1. It doesn't mix with the Higgs. This is the one of the top, which mixes with the Higgs. This is the normalization of the G1. And then you can integrate over this profile and get the actual coupling of G1 to the pair of fermions. So, and you can do the same for the T1, WB, or all this, the couplings of T1 to H top and C top. So you can get all those couplings. Here we have the two plots of the couplings and how they depend on the bulk mass C1, the bulk mass of the first multiplet. And you see that in the regions where C1 is positive, actually this is the coupling of G1 to a pair of tops. Definitely, one thing that I should say is that since the left-handed and right-handed guys have different profiles, the couplings to them are going to be different. So, but however, when C1 is positive and close to 0.2, actually these two couplings unite at a common value of the order of 2 times the strong coupling. And in the case of G1, two pairs of T1s, the one to the left-handed one basically remains always big. And then for C1 positive, this one grows to about, again, 2.3 times the strong coupling. So you see from this plot that definitely G1, at least in this region of parameter space, will have a stronger interaction with the T1 states than it does with tops. Okay. So like I told you, once we have the coupling, we can calculate the decay branching ratios. And these are the plots that I have here. the branching ratios of T1 to WB, CT, and Higgs-top. And one thing that you can see here is that when the T1 mass becomes big, you actually you get the usual 2-1-1 relationship from the Goldstone equivalence theory. Okay, so basically T1 likes to decay more into WB than twice as much into WB as in Higgs-top and CT. So okay, so that's one thing that you can see there. And then another thing that you can see here is that the where here's the branching ratios of G1 to pair of top, T1T1, T1T, and BB bar. And then the blue one is the one corresponds to T1T1. So you see that around 60 or 70% of the times, I mean, it's, this, the branch ratio is about 60 or 70%. One thing that I should say is that this G1 is actually not a narrow resonance, but because now it's decaying to this T1, it becomes a broad resonance. So it's very hard to reconstruct its mass. Okay, it becomes very difficult. And that has, like I told you, this has to do with the fact that this becomes a broad resonance. It's not narrow. So previous studies have to try to reconstruct the G1 mass would be in trouble, in this case at least.
And how broad is it?
How narrow? Yeah, about 37%, 40%, something like that, the mass of G1. Okay. Okay, so this is a plot. So what we did is we simulated this using MAD graph at Parton level, and then we used Pythia to think about the hadronization, say. And then we used PGS4 to simulate the detector. So at Parton level, assuming taking a G1 mass of the order of 4 TeV, you can see, I'm taking these couplings here. Here we have a plot of the cross-section, of the production cross-section versus the T1 mass. And you see that for the T1 mass that we care, which are the ones that basically from here up, so this region here, you see that the G1s would actually have a great impact. So this is this curve, basically what I'm showing here is so G2 pairs of T1s, which is the green curve, G1 to pairs of T1s, which is the blue curve, and then the thing that you will actually see in the detectors, which is the sum of the two contributions. So you see that the contribution that comes from G1 decays is actually pretty big in the regions that are consistent with the model. Okay? So and actually you can show that the two things actually interfere constructively. So that can be shown. I won't go there, but that can be shown. Okay. So like I told you, from the Goldstone equivalence theorem, 50% of the time, T1 decays into WB. So this is the channel that we will concentrate. And we're going to take that one of the Ws decays hadronically and the other one leptonically. Okay? So the backgrounds for the signals are the huge top background that comes from the decays of this G1 in addition to the QCD. Then you also have W plus jet and C plus jet. However, those backgrounds can be brought to manageable levels by requiring two BTACs and lepton plus sensitivity. So we took two points of the parameter space to analyze, one with a slightly higher G1 mass and T1 mass, one with a slightly slower, lower, sorry. And for reconstruction of the W mass from the massive jets, we took a cone delta R of the order of 0.6. Basically, because what happens when you have this this very heavy states T1 and things decay, you can treat your W as a massive jet, and that actually improves a lot the signal when you do that. And I'll show that. I show some plots where we do this.
Okay.
So the first cuts that we put at the the initial. Before passing through Pythia, we demand an isolated lepton, missing energy, T bigger than 20 GeV, or T also bigger than 20 GeV, then we will increment this cut. And then we demanded three jets, because of the massive jet, that's why we don't have four here, with PT bigger than 20 GeV and two bottom tags. Okay? And so here there's a table where we have the cross sections, the number of events before the cuts, and this is the number of events actually after the final cuts. It's cuts that I will show you in the next slide. Okay. So, and this is at a luminosity of 300 inverse Spectrum. So as you can see, I mean, there are not that many events, but also the background is very small. So this has a chance. Actually, with this number of events and the number of backgrounds, the significance, the statistical significance is of the order of 5 sigma for one of the points, for both of the points. Okay. So here what I have is a plot where you have the events. So this is normalized to 200 events in terms of the PT of the bottom and the HD.
What is the luminosity? Sorry.
300.
Inverse.
Yeah, so this would be
N0 after cuts is the signal event?
This is the background.
Yeah. Point 2 is the... Sorry. Well, what is the signal event after cuts?
The signal event would be this one, 24.
Oh.
And 14. The background is 7 and 6.
Sorry, the signal is 7, background 6?
No. 24 is the signal, 7 is the background for one point,
oh.
14 is the signal, 6 is the background.
So the background is mainly coming from the model itself. You produce the G1 but decays the TP bar.
Yes.
Not the standard model.
Yes, yes. Actually, this, as you can see, well, this is huge, right?
Yeah.
Actually, I wouldn't even have to plot it here.
Uh-huh.
But this actually decays at higher. So, I mean, it's actually hard to say whether it's coming from here or not.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, what you can see from this plot is basically that if you put a PT cut here, somewhere over here, and somewhere over here on the HD, you can actually cut the background a lot. But still, this is very big, so you don't know actually what it actually what is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. So, like I told you, here's where we use the two methods actually to see which one is the one that works better. So remember, one of the W's is decaying hadronically. So you can what we try to do is reconstruct the W mass, and one of the methods is the one that uses the two jets to reconstruct the W mass, and that one works well for T1 masses that are less than 1 TeV. Okay, that uses this delta R to be 0.4. The other one, which is the massive jet, just basically is taking W to one jet. This one works well for higher masses, and it increases the signal and decreases the background. The way to understand this is that usually these T1s are produced at rest, okay, because of the broad resonance of the G1. So G1 is broad resonance, you produce these T1s at rest. And then when this T1 decays, so it decays into WB, the W and the B will be basically back to back, okay? And then the W is going to decay into two jets. But to reconstruct the W, okay, so you can get a very nice signal reconstructing W just with one massive jet, since the other one is going backwards. And in the case of the background, what happens is that the T actually is pretty boosted, okay, when it decays. So the G1 going to TT, that one is pretty boosted. And when it decays to WB, the W and the B are going to be kind of going forward. So you see that when you actually reconstruct the W and the B may contaminate your cone, and that's what makes it bad. So that's why you increase the signal and increases the background. So you can see here, actually, the reconstruction of the W using some window of 20 GeV, if I remember, where this is the case where you treat it as a massive jet, and you can reconstruct it very nicely, not so much.
Sorry, what is your G1?
Yes.
My mass of G1 again is 4 TeV?
4 TeV, well, 3.5, yeah. 4
in that case, shouldn't you just reconstruct top mass when you use the jet to the G1 goes to TT bar?
This is G1
for your background.
No, but the T is so that's what I'm saying. So the T1 actually you created at rest.
I know. No, but the T top.
Yeah, the top actually is going forward. Yes.
So shouldn't you just, if you take that jet and ask for its inner mass?
No, but then the B also contaminates when you reconstruct the W.
I'm just saying, if you just take the whole thing, it shouldn't.
The whole thing?
Mm.
I have no idea.
Sorry, you were saying the jet mass, but...
Yes, so what I'm saying is that you have the G that is going here, then decays into the W and the B.
Sorry.
Yes?
You demand
two
B tags.
I demand two B tags, exactly.
Okay. All right, then you subtract B.
Yes.
I see.
Okay. Okay, so the final cuts that we impose are these ones. This is for the two different points, and this is like a common cut. Here, PT left, and you see this one actually decreases your signal quite a bit, but it's necessary. This is the cut on the jet of the highest PT jet. This is the one to reconstruct the W mass. And this one, basically, what it is sometimes you're going to reconstruct the top from the WB. So we put this cut to be bigger than 50 GB. So this one is not going to affect the signal, but it's going to affect the back. It's going to decrease the back. So when you do that, and here we plot the invariant T1 mass versus the number of events, you see that you can see a peak somewhere over here. Okay, there's very little number of events. This is at 300 inverse spectrum, by the way. And this one is at 100. So this is for the first. So this is the first point, which is the more massive one. This is for the second point, which is a little bit less massive, a T1 mass of the order of 1250, something like that. And if I remember correctly, this is at 200 inverse spectrum, if I remember correctly, or 150, I can't remember. But anyway, you see that you can sort of see a signal there, and then that you have diminished the backgrounds quite a bit. You can also see that if you would only be considering just QCD production, which would be this case, the green case, then the background on the signal, it would be very hard to actually see anything, right? You wouldn't be able to see much. This is the background, this is the signal in the case of just QCD, and this is the signal with QCD plus G1. Mm-hmm. The same thing you can see here. And almost done. Okay, so we estimate the statistical significance basically by signal over signal plus 5 to 1/2. And then here, if you include K factors, which basically take into account the higher loop corrections, they are of the order of 1.5, let's say, then you can see that there may be some indications of the particles already at 100 Siemens femtobarn for the what we call 0.1, the more massive spectrum, and 60 Siemens femtobarn at 0.2. And then 5 sigma discovery at 300 is my friend about 4.1 and 200 is my friend. This plot here, what it tries to show, let's see if I can explain this, is so this is a plot of the G1 mass versus the T1 mass at a luminosity of 300 inverse femtobarn, okay, at ABC. And these curves here, this one and this one, What they are constant cross-section curves for 30 femtobarn and 15 femtobarn cross-sections. This one, 15 femtobarn, is the one that corresponds to a detection of a T1 at 300 inverse femtobarn. Okay, this is this curve here. And then 30 femtobarn is the smallest cross section where you can still detect you can still detect this T1 resonances just with QCD, okay, and it corresponds to this curve here. So if I want to see the QCD limit, that corresponds to basically taking MG1 to infinity. So this would be the reach of just QCD alone, okay, right here. And then the point that we had, it corresponded to inverse 50 femtobarn. It corresponds to a mass between, if I remember, 1500 or something. So it's a point somewhere over here. Okay. Okay. So from QCD alone, you can only see to this part here. However, when you start including G1, one thing that I should say: these aren't just kinematical cuts. Okay. These things here are just kind of. This one you don't have any decay of G1 to pair of T1s. So just from QCD alone, you would be able to see probe this region here. However, when you take QCD plus the G1 decays, the actually region that you will probe is some region that is between these two curves here. So it's a region that actually interpolates the point here, this point here, with this point over here. Okay. So and then this region here is basically the region that is allowed by our model of gauging simplification. You can actually get a correspondence between the G1 mass and the T1 mass. So you see that at the LHC, in principle, we should be able to probe at least this part of the parameter space of the model. Obviously, there are higher masses, this thing goes higher, and then you wouldn't be able to probe it. But at least this interesting part would be able to probe at the end. Okay, so conclusions, electroweak symmetry breaking. We found electroweak symmetry breaking that's consistent in regions given by the electroweak precision test. The Higgs mass is between 116 GeV and 160 GeV, which is phenomenologically interesting. The first KK excitation of the top quark is light enough to be produced from the decays of this G1 state, the first excited state of the gluon. There's a rich collider phenomenology. The G1 decays actually expand the reach of the heavy quark surge to masses at around 1.5 TeV. And the model is consistent phenomenologically and will be tested at least. Thank you.
Questions? So two questions.
Yes. No, we haven't considered that, and someone brought that up also before. It would be interesting to consider.
The rate, I think, for the mass you consider is that the rate of that is probably bigger than the PCB calculation.
Yeah, there are some studies of that in the little Higgs models.
Yeah,
and
you probably can just translate that result into.
Yeah.
But there is an Atlas study. I mean,
yeah?
Basically.
Okay.
Exactly doing that.
Okay.
EW and decay back to EW,
uh-huh.
But W is so boosted you can probably just use the lepton to reconstruct the resonance of T prime, or in the little Higgs prime.
Yeah.
So the second question is, I'm a little bit surprised that the TT bar is such a serious background for you, because
the TT bar is what?
TT bar.
Yeah.
G1 goes to TT bar.
Yes.
Because as you said, the TT bar is very boosted.
Yes.
And the T1 actually produces almost rest.
Yes.
So shouldn't I expect that the G1 goes to a pair of T1 when decays? I roughly see four things in the event, and the W is still boosted at one.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it goes to TT bar, I roughly see two things in the event.
Yeah.
Because TT bar is just two cones.
The thing is that.
For the G1,
the problem is that G1 here is a broad resonance.
Yeah,
I think that affects.
But what is the typical boost that PP bar has? Let's take your G1 4 TeV.
Yeah.
Now let's say the width is, 1 TeV.
Mm-hmm.
Then the PP bar should at least have some S hat of 3 TeV.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If that's the case, I think most of the PP bar events are two cones. Just
yes,
and you should have something like sphericity or whatever. Just
mm-hmm.
the number of objects, the angle between two
mm-hmm.
B's.
Yeah,
it could be.
We didn't go that much into that on that,
uh-huh.
But maybe.
But these two things kinematically are very different.
Maybe.
So.
Let's thank Annabelle again.